from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sarah Dwider.
And I'm Sam Hirschman.
This week on War News Radio, miscommunications, we learn about protests in Afghanistan.
Then, we hear about communications in Libya.
Finally, we talk to a journalist who was kidnapped in Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The new U.S. Army Chief of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, told reporters that U.S. troops may be in Iraq past 2011. In a press briefing at the Pentagon, Dempsey told journalists that U.S. soldiers would stay in Iraq past December if Iraqi forces requested support. There are approximately 47,000 U.S. troops currently in Iraq, although these troops are scheduled to leave by the end of the year. The comments have sparked protests across Iraq, as well as threats from Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. In a statement read to his supporters, al-Sadr wrote, "The first thing we will do is escalate the military resistance activity and reactivate the Mahdi Army." The Mahdi Army, a Shia militia founded by al-Sadr, was a major force of sectarian violence in Iraq until it was disbanded in 2008.
Iraqi forces attempted to dismantle Camp Ashraf, a residential area for Iranian exiles from the Mujahideen People's Organization. The UN confirmed the deaths of 34 camp residents and the wounding of 318 more. Hospitalized residents have been forced to return to the camps. The Iranian government considers the Iranian dissidents a terrorist group, and the camp's presence in Iraq has strained relations between the two countries. The residents have been given until the end of the year to leave Iraq, but were granted permission to return to Iran.
Two car bombs went off near a school and market in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, leaving at least 6 people dead and 20 wounded. The attacks also caused significant damage to nearby shops and buildings. The first bomb detonated as two policemen tried to defuse it, and both officers were killed in the explosion. The second bomb, located only 150 meters away from the first, detonated 15 minutes later. Although Fallujah has seen relatively little violence in the past year, insurgent attacks are rising again.
CIA drones fired two missiles targeting militants in Pakistan just 2 days after the Pakistani government requested that the U.S. limit drone strikes. The Pakistani government strongly condemned the attacks, saying that drone strikes only contribute to strengthen the hands of the terrorists. The attacks increased the long-standing diplomatic tension over military operations in Pakistan and further strained U.S. relations with the country.
The UN reported this week that the number of violent attacks against humanitarian aid workers has tripled in the last decade. More than 100 deaths are reported each year. The areas with the highest number of casualties are those involved in armed conflicts, including Afghanistan, Sudan, and Somalia. The high number of fatalities may reflect the increase in aid group activity seen in the past few years.
At the NATO summit in Berlin, NATO members agreed that Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi must be removed from power. But NATO itself will not remove him. The 28 member nations present at the summit were divided over whether to remove Gaddafi, but decided to pass on direct confrontation. U.S. representatives, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, advocated unity among the summit members, but resisted suggestions that the U.S. take on a larger military role in Libya.
NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen asked a summit of foreign ministers to supply more warplanes for NATO military operations in Libya. The request for additional air support came 10 days after the U.S. ended strike missions in Libya. The U.S. and French governments said that they have no plans to supply more warplanes and called on other NATO members to lead the campaign against Gaddafi.
NATO warplanes bombed the Libyan capital of Tripoli this week, as well as Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. These airstrikes coincided with the NATO summit's agreement that Gaddafi must leave Libya and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's call for a ceasefire. Gaddafi responded with anti-aircraft fire and shelled the port city of Misrata, a center for Libyan rebel forces. 13 people were killed and 50 wounded in Gaddafi's attack.
This is War News Radio. Earlier this month, Afghan civilians stormed a UN compound in northern Afghanistan, killing 7 employees. They were incited by a video of a small-time Christian pastor setting fire to a Quran halfway around the world. Almondi Lee looks deeper at the incident and at the coverage of the protests in America and international media in a new installment of our media analysis series.
On the first Friday of April, protests broke out in Mazar-i-Sharif in northern Afghanistan, escalating into a violent mob that stormed a UN office and killed at least 12. Protests then spread across the country to Jalalabad, Kandahar province, and Parwan province. Some were peaceful, but the overall death toll was at least 24. If this sounds like the Afghan people are rising up to overthrow the corrupt, inefficient Karzai government, they're not, at least not primarily. The Associated Press reported on the violence last week.
The violence was set off by anger over the March 20th burning of the Quran by a Florida church.
Mainstream American coverage of the protests have focused mainly on the constitutional rights and moral wrongs of its instigator, Pastor Terry Jones. Numerous American officials, including President Barack Obama, have come out strongly against the protests, as did General David Petraeus in this AP report.
We condemn the action of an individual in the United States who burned a holy Quran. That action was hateful, it was intolerant, and it was extremely disrespectful.
This is the debate. Terry Jones certainly has the First Amendment right to put the Quran on trial, find it guilty, and condemn it to burning on his private property in front of a group of a few dozen members of his congregation. However, should he be allowed to when the anger it incites abroad threatens American troops and indeed caused the death of 7 UN employees? Senator Lindsey Graham told CBS's Face the Nation that he is looking for recourse.
You know, I wish we could find some way to hold people accountable. Free speech is a great idea, but we're in a war. During World War II, you had limits on what you could say if it would inspire the enemy. So burning a Quran is a terrible thing, but it doesn't justify killing someone. Burning a Bible would be a terrible thing, but it wouldn't justify murder. But having said that, anytime we can push back here in America against actions like this that put our troops at risk, we ought to do it.
Little media attention was given to the burning as it occurred, and the hubbub in America only really began after the violent protests in Afghanistan, a full month later. This is compared to last fall, when Terry Jones's stated intent to burn the Quran on the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks caused immediate backlash across America and the Muslim world.
The president today said burning sacred texts of someone else's religion is contrary to what this nation stands for, and he accused Pastor Jones of jeopardizing the safety of U.S. troops.
We are seeing today riots in Kabul.
The disapproval was strong enough that Jones originally agreed to back off on his International Burn a Quran Day. This time, only Afghanistan saw any demonstrations. This begs the question, why only Afghanistan, and where did the furor come from? American news organizations haven't touched on these subjects in depth, but Al Jazeera focused their half-hour segment, Inside Story, on investigating the driving factors behind the protests and their implications for American foreign policy. Opinions vary as to whether the demonstrations were homegrown or incited.
What do you think was behind this violence? Was it people, was it local Afghans, or was it foreign elements, as some people have said?
The demonstration that started in Mazar was, I believe very strongly, was done at the instigation of the enemies of Afghanistan and the enemies, like the foreign Taliban and the Al-Qaeda.
But remember, Mazar-i-Sharif is an area where the Taliban have very little power. It's not their heartland at all. And I think it just shows that when the Taliban describe the foreign occupation as sort of infidels, it echoes with these people. They do feel angry. And I think that, you know, when I've traveled through parts of Afghanistan, this type of attitude is not something that needs to be instigated by a small group of Taliban. It can actually be felt by the people there and resonate with them.
The BBC, meanwhile, is quick to point out that the Taliban itself takes no responsibility for the protests.
But the insurgents insist they were not behind the unrest of the street protests. The foreigners brought the people's wrath upon themselves, said a Taliban spokesman.
Jones's actions took time to gather public condemnation because the videos of the trial and the fire that he posted on YouTube were ignored in America, but slowly picked up by Middle Eastern news channels. President Karzai himself released a statement on March 24th criticizing Jones, and then publicly called for his arrest on March 31st, the day before the violent protests in Mazar-e-Sharif. Attention in Islamic countries outside Afghanistan, however, remains focused on domestic politics rather than on the actions of a controversial Christian minority in America. Is it possible that the occupation of Afghanistan has embittered its citizens towards Westerners, making the sentiment behind these protests possible? Or is it just indignation over the lack of respect for Islam? This is an important question, as there are thousands of foreign troops and NGOs in Afghanistan, theoretically there to help, but vulnerable to similar attacks. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. Since the NATO intervention in Libya and the preceding rebellion, many cities in the country have been embroiled in violence. This has damaged infrastructure across the country. Particularly, communications networks have suffered significantly. Aaron Moser has more on the situation.
Conflicts have been fought within a country, by the people within those geographical boundaries. Wall Street Journal reporter Margaret Coker, speaking in a video posted by her newspaper, describes new influences in the conflict in Libya.
That's right. What we've seen, people like me who've been covering Libya for the last month or so, we have watched a group of expatriates, a lot of Libyan Americans, Libyan Brits. They've been working behind the scenes, doing back-channel diplomacy, also doing a lot of humanitarian work that has been keeping the rebel movement alive in Benghazi.
Osama Abu Shagor is one of these people. He's a 31-year-old Libyan-American telecommunications executive living in the United Arab Emirates. According to the journal, he is leading an effort to provide technological assistance to the Libyan rebels. Since the start of the uprising against Colonel Gaddafi in February, Libyan internet and phone networks have been in and out of service, and free communication has been almost impossible to come by. Now, a new mobile phone network has been established that is allowing Libyans, rebels and civilians alike, to communicate more freely with each other and the outside world. Ordinarily, mobile providers in Libya are highly controlled by the government. One of the largest networks, Libyana, is based out of Tripoli and run by the dictator's eldest son, Muhammad al-Gaddafi. Abu Shagor explained the decision to hijack Libyana to the IT website The Register, which stated that Libyana was selected not because it happens to be run by Gaddafi's son, but because its network infrastructure was well known and local engineers in Benghazi could be relied upon to help. The new network is called Free Libyana, and according to Wired magazine, it provides service to over 2 million people. Abu Shagor's contacts, both in Libya and in telecommunications, enabled him to accomplish this task. The Wall Street Journal reported that wealthy governments in the Persian Gulf helped to create the network. The article read, "In a sign of deepening ties between Arab governments and the Benghazi-based administration, the UAE and Qatar provided diplomatic support and helped buy the several million dollars of telecommunications equipment needed in Benghazi." It also quoted a Benghazi government official as saying, "The Emirates government and its telecommunications company, Etislat, helped us by providing the equipment we needed to operate Libyana at full capacity." However, while speaking with the Register, Abu Shagor denied these claims. He said of the aid supposedly provided by foreign governments, "I wish they did. We raised all the money from Libyans who could see it was important. We're still waiting for all the money and equipment media reports say we have received." This new network provides critical support to the revolution. Gaddafi's control over communication systems and the jamming of satellite phones had left the rebels with no way to communicate among themselves. The Wall Street Journal published a quote from General, a rebel commander in Benghazi, who described the dysfunction within the rebels during battle. "We went to fight with flags. Yellow meant retreat, green meant advance. Gaddafi forced us back into the Stone Age." But Free Libyana is not only helping the rebels organize within Libya. The Telegraph reports that it is allowing the rebels to network around the globe. It writes, "Authorities in eastern Libya are also using their improvised mobile communications to forge international links as they seek to galvanize support for their war against Colonel Gaddafi. The future for the people of Libya remains unclear. The founding of Free Libyana may prove to be a pivotal moment." For War News Radio, I'm Aaron Moser.
David Rode was kidnapped in November 2008 by the Taliban. He and his wife, Kirsten Mulvihill, photography director at Cosmopolitan magazine, recently chronicled their experiences with the kidnapping in the book A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. We hear from Rode and Mulvihill about his 7.5 months in captivity, the emotional and psychological aspects of the situation, and the resulting insight to the most powerful faction of the Taliban. Eliana Bisgard Church has the story.
The driver punches the accelerator, and we cross into the open desert. The gunman in the front seat aims his Kalashnikov assault rifle at us. No one speaks. I glance at the bleak landscape outside, reddish soil and black boulders as far as the eye can see. I fear we will be dead within minutes.
That was David Rode, a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. When in Bosnia covering the Srebrenica massacre, for which he earned his first Pulitzer Prize, Rode was captured and held for 10 days. 13 years later, in November 2008, he was captured by a much different group, the Taliban. His work with the New York Times, covering Afghanistan and Pakistan, for which he won his second Pulitzer in 2009, had not prepared him for this. His life, and that of his wife of only 2 months, Kristen Mulvihill, was thrust into chaos.
I had been covering Afghanistan for the New York Times since 2001, and I had actually gone on a book leave and was working on a book about the American effort to stabilize the region and sort of what had gone wrong. And on this last trip, it was the fall of 2008, and I was shocked at the sort of strength of the Taliban resurgence and how popular they seemed to have become with people there. So I felt for the book to be as accurate and thorough as possible, I should really have a Taliban character. And I had heard about this Taliban commander who had given interviews to 2 foreign journalists before. I met with a foreign journalist who had interviewed him actually twice, and she said, you know, you are on more danger as an American, but I don't think he'll kidnap you. And off we went to the interview, and unfortunately it was all a trap. When we arrived at the meeting point, we were told to keep driving down the road, and then nearby we were abducted by Taliban gunmen, and that was the beginning of our 7 months in captivity.
David had just gone back overseas, as he mentioned, to report on his book, and I just started a job at Cosmopolitan magazine as the photography director. So our daily environments were very different and the content we were dealing with. And I found out about the kidnapping at work, actually.
Rode writes in his book that he thought they were about to be killed at that moment. Little did he know that they were to survive and stay in captivity for the next 7.5 months. Rode was captured with his driver, Asadullah Mangal, and translator Tahir Ludin, by a man who called himself Atikola, a name the three would later learn was an alias for Abu Tayyeb, the Taliban commander Rode thought he had arranged an interview with. Back in New York City, Mulvihill was plunged into disarray when she heard of the kidnapping.
David's brother Lee called me and said that David hadn't returned from his last interview. Right away, I was sort of thrust into this other world. I tried to gather myself and just kind of ran home and had to go actually up to New England to meet with FBI agents there. and then the following day went to meet with editors at the New York Times. So it was a real whirlwind of dealing with different organizations. I was trained by the FBI to expect calls at some point from his captors. All our phone calls were recorded. I also met with State Department officials, with my brother-in-law, Lee. We tried to do everything we could as a family. We wanted to feel like no stone had been left unturned.
It turns out that Rhode had been captured by the powerful Haqqani network within the Taliban, which operates in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The network began as the militant Jalaluddin Haqqani rose to power fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s. The U.S. also funded the Haqqani network in their opposition to the Soviets at the time. The group was the first and strongest backer of Osama bin Laden. Today, Jalaluddin's son, Sirajuddin Haqqani, leads the network based in North Waziristan, Pakistan, where Rhode was held captive. Sirajuddin led the kidnapping of Rhode in order to make money, asking initially for a ransom of $25 million and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. For this reason, Rhode believes, they did not abuse or become violent with Rhode and treated him relatively well.
I think it was primarily greed. And, I was lucky in a sense that they had me because they wanted money. I had a sense that the commander who kidnapped me, he reminded me of sort of a young capo in an organized crime family who was trying to use my case to make his name. There was lots of determination to try to get more prisoners and more money than had been received by another Taliban commander. They saw me as worth a lot of money, and that's what kept me alive. I was lucky in that sense.
Through living with the members of the Taliban, Rhode witnessed an inside view into their extreme ideologies.
One of the ironies of my case is that in the 1980s, the father, the sort of patriarch of the family, Jalaluddin Haqqani, he brought Congressman Charlie Wilson. Congressman Wilson was a Democrat from the Houston, Texas area who funded the anti-Soviet Mujahideen. And the Haqqanis brought Congressman Wilson in, gave him a tour of their efforts to fight the Soviets, and actually let Congressman Wilson fire a few rockets at a Soviet base. And Wilson was so impressed and so delighted that he referred to Jalaluddin Haqqani as, quote-unquote, goodness personified. A few decades later, Jalaluddin Haqqani's sons kidnapped me and said that as an American, I was their mortal enemy. So this militant Islam that we favored when it was used to kill young Soviet soldiers, you know, has sort of turned into this Frankenstein that's come back to haunt us. And people again say, why do we care? It's not our problem. We have some role in creating this mess, and it is a direct threat to the United States. And there are plots against the U.S., you know, made in these tribal areas of Pakistan. So for those reasons, that's why I think we need to, again, find ways to kind of effectively help local moderates counter the extremism there.
The extent of the extremist Taliban ideology and propaganda was shocking to Rhode. And he was also surprised by the fact that the Pakistani military did so little to combat the Taliban.
And I think the extent of how hands-off the Pakistanis were towards the Taliban really shocked me. My guards took bomb-making classes at one point every day in this large town, Miran Shah. It's the largest town in a place called North Waziristan. And they would set up these enormous explosions in the middle of the town. And there is a Pakistani military base in Miran Shah, and the Pakistani soldiers never came off the base to investigate what was happening. The Haqqanis were so confident of their control of North Waziristan. It's a Taliban mini-state that's, you know, thriving there today. Faisal Shahzad, the young man that tried to set off the bomb in Times Square last year, he was trained in North Waziristan, and so was Najibullah Zazi, another young Afghan-American who he was planning to set off a bomb in the subways in New York City, also trained in North Waziristan. So it's astonishing and sort of really distressing to me that the Taliban mini-state there continues to thrive.
While engulfed in this world of extremism, both Rhode and Mulvihill experienced ironies. In captivity, Rhode's captors would on one hand make him watch Taliban propaganda DVDs glorifying suicide bombing and desensitizing viewers to American deaths with graphic footage, and on the other hand would make him sing songs like The Beatles' She Loves You at night when they were bored. Meanwhile, Mulvihill straddled the American fashion world, at the same time receiving phone calls from the FBI, State Department, and Taliban in her New York City office.
And the one thing I felt was very ironic, like in my experience with talking to his captors, there was a moment where, you know, I was always told to say I was praying for David because they would relate to that. And I was, you know. And at one point I said to them, you know, I'm praying for all of you. And their response was, God bless you. And it was kind of, kind of funny, but it's sort of the one thing we might have in common as a belief in something else. And yet it gets turned into this battle, which is unfortunate.
Coping with the kidnapping was truly an exercise of will, determination, and faith for the couple.
For me, family support was tremendous. For my brother-in-law, Lee, from David's family, my mom came in and stayed with me. I continued to go to work. In midday, I'd have an update from the security team in Kabul every day about what was going on or wasn't going on with his case. Also, I talked to former hostages, which was very helpful. It's a very isolating experience, and to know someone else that survived similar situation was tremendously empowering for me. And faith played a large role for me as well. And just kind of surrendering to a higher force and believing something would look out for him.
And for me, you know, I sort of thought it was my job to just kind of get through the day, and it was basically my job to survive. I knew that Kristen and my family and my colleagues at the paper would be doing everything they could to help us. So I just really felt like I had to kind of keep my nose down and do whatever I needed to do to survive. And I had little things I did every day. I had chores. I had things that they gave me to read. I listened to the BBC a lot. I was treated very, very well. During our captivity, I was never beaten. They actually gave me bottled water every day, and they called me the golden rooster, expecting me to lay a golden egg in terms of a large ransom. And I did have a set of prayers I said, and they were very informal prayers that I just sort of made up, essentially praying that, you know, no one would die, praying that my family wouldn't worry so much. And I'm sort of skeptical of organized religion. I've seen religious extremism. I've seen Christian extremists in Bosnia do horrible things, Hindu extremists in India do brutal things, and these were Muslim extremists that kidnapped us. But I don't know if prayer for someone, you know, if there actually is a God who hears you when you pray, or if it's just sort of a psychological trick. But when you're in that kind of powerless situation, I did find that saying these prayers leave me more sort of calm and centered.
Rhodes' experience taught him much about the Taliban. And he believes
the most important thing I think for readers to understand about what's happening in Afghanistan is that in a sense, rivalry between India and Pakistan is playing out on the ground in Afghanistan with American troops, in a sense, caught in the middle. The reason that the Pakistani military is allowing the Taliban to sort of have shelter inside Pakistan is that the Pakistani military sees the Taliban as these very valuable proxies they can use to reduce India's influence in Afghanistan. There's a real fear among the Pakistani military that India is trying to take over Afghanistan. That would allow India, in a sense, to surround Pakistan. I think those fears are exaggerated, but it's interesting. There's a WikiLeaks cable where the U.S. ambassador in Pakistan points out that no amount of military aid is going to break this tie between the Pakistani military and the Taliban, and that the U.S. actually had initially encouraged India to be more active in Afghanistan after 2001. And again, we just sort of, you know, are thinking too much in the short term and not understanding the region. That increased Indian involvement just sort of played on Pakistani fears. So a key thing is to try to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan.
To listen to the second half of this piece, first aired in March, visit our site, warnewsradio.org, and search for David Rhode. That's R-O-H-D-E. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Caroline Batten, Eliana Biscard Church, Emily Bryan, John McMinn, Min Nguyen Nguyen, Jared Nolan, Jeremy Rappaport-Stein, Colin Smith, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Sarah Dwider. Until next time, thanks for listening.